Remaker's Mark Episode 12, The Shining. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Remaker's Mark. Tonight, we continue our conversation of the 1980 psychological horror film, The Shining. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight? And what is your favorite movie from a Stephen King book?
I'm very well, thank you. My favorite Stephen King book adapted into a movie would be... Well, first of all, I couldn't think of any that I had actually seen other than The Shining, and then everyone else on the show helped me realize that I've seen several. So thank you. And my favorite would be Stand By Me.
Ah, good pick. Yep. That's one that's not super, super well known. Was the story called Stand By Me? Those of you who remember that, which I totally don't.
I believe so.
No idea.
Okay. Yeah, I can't remember.
It was from different seasons.
Oh, that's right. With Richard Bachman. Got it.
What did that guy say in City Pages about us being well-researched?
Frighteningly well-researched. We'll just edit that out.
He was lying.
I'll just put in a Mac and Talk voice saying, Stand By Me was a book.
Stand By Me was a book.
All right.
No Jeremy flaws Nilsen. In that plan. All right.
Nope, none at all. Jeremy Nilsen, how are you doing? And what was your favorite movie from a Stephen King book?
It is impossible for me to be any better than I am right now. And my favorite Stephen King adaptation, The Shining notwithstanding, because that's what we're going to be talking about, so I'll leave that one off the table, is probably The Running Man.
Ooh, good one.
Nice.
Thank you.
Has anybody read The Long Walk? It's one of those, I think, Richard Bachman ones. It's, I think, in the same one as The Running Man. It's kind of like the dystopian future Hunger Games style sort of thing, where the big future competition is about this, like, you just basically walk, and if you go under 3 miles an hour or 2.5 miles an hour, you get 2 warnings, and then you're killed.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a great, great story, and there's just an article recently about
it. Wait, a dystopian speed walking story? That's
right. Is Keanu Reeves in it?
When you put it that way, it does sound a little silly.
Don't walk below 3. So is it like a speed walking race like at the Olympics, and that's how they lose, is they just die?
It's an endurance competition, and you have like 15 people like that are in the prime of their lives, and then the winner gets like everything. You know, they get like all the wealth in the world or something like that. But it's a big like participation thing where everybody watches it on TV. So it's very much Hunger Games-esque in that way. Anyways,
so I always Hunger Games that would be minus one. The bow and arrow plus walking around.
Yeah. Plus sneakers. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. So not the running man, the walking man. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Lee Hassenpfeffer, how are you tonight? And what is your favorite movie from a Stephen King book?
I'm great. And I'm going to have to say The Shawshank Redemption, even though I'm sure many people would say that it's kind of an easy one. But that was my favorite movie for a while.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's a great movie. I think that's been the number one movie on IMDb for years and years and years and years. Yeah. Nothing has unseated it, as far as I know.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Top three, at least.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. Godfather's always up there, too. Yep, good one. And that one was, I think, Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption when Stephen King wrote it.
Yep. And it was a novella also in different seasons.
Yep. Wow. So. Apparently, I need to go and reread that because that's quite compelling.
Yeah.
Mark Josting, you're a little under the weather, so how are you doing in spite of that? And what is your favorite Stephen King adaptation?
Not bad, despite the health, but... I think I also have to go with Stand By Me. It's just an excellent story.
It is. It is. It is indeed. Featuring so many people that I like admire, you know, just so many actors and people from our age that are, you know, pretty much our age now-ish, you know, give or take a few years. So yeah, definitely. Well, my name is Kyle Delahunt. I am your host here this evening. And for my pick, I'm going to have to go with Carrie. That was maybe the first Stephen King movie that I saw, or Stephen King related movie that I saw. And man, did that scare the hell out of me. It's so, so well done. I'm very intrigued by the remake that they're doing, sort of a tie-in there. They're doing one with, is it Chloe Grace Moretz, I think,
really?
Right? As Carrie. Yep. Yep. Oh. And Julianne Moore as her mom. So it's...
Oh, wow.
Casting-wise, it looks good. I have no idea who's directing it or anything, but I'm intrigued, but I'm a little scared at the same time. So We shall see, but I have hope. So yeah, I think that's a great movie, and it captured the spirit of the book well, and it's just a terrifying, terrifying, very 70s-ish movie. So yeah, and Sissy Spacek is fantastic. All right, so tonight we are talking about The Shining, but before we do so, I want to thank our friends at Tipsy Pixels for their promotional consideration.
Tipsy Pixels is a monthly retro video game contest hosted by Nels Lenz of Huge Theater. It features drink specials from Tallgrass Brewing, and players can win prizes from Level Up Games, as well as free drinks and tickets to shows. The next event is October 17th as part of the Minneapolis Institute of Arts Third Thursday festivities. To find out more information about Tipsy Pixels, head to tipsypixels.com or follow them on Twitter at tipsypixels.
All right, thanks again for Tipsy Pixels for their promotional consideration. Before we move on to our discussion of The Shining, we want to just address some feedback that we got about some casting options that you, our faithful listeners, provided regarding the recasting portion of The Shining. So we put a call out to Twitter and Facebook, as usual, and got lots of good responses. So from Facebook, Andrew Grun said, "I kind of feel like Lars von Trier already did remake The Shining. It starred Willem Dafoe and Charlotte Gainsbourg and was titled Antichrist, which I thought was really interesting. I have yet to be able to make it past about the first 4 minutes of Antichrist. I'm a Lars von Trier fan, but you just have to be in the right mood for his movies, and I just haven't been. But
I don't know what the right mood is for that movie.
Yeah, yeah, it seems pretty punishing. But I will ultimately see it at some point, and I will certainly see it with that in mind. So yeah, that's really interesting. That's good feedback, Andrew. Thank you. Colin Kearns, who writes the Chartered Trips blog here on MathisHard.net, suggested Nick Cage in Nicholson's role, really, he said, and I think I'm down with that. That's great. That's a good crazy. Jeremy Dorsing just simply stated Matt Damon, which no arguments there.
I think he said it like they do in Team America.
Matt Damon.
Tony Mayer said Matthew Good was particularly chilling in Stoker. I think he could pull off the transition from sane to bat quite well. Jess Angus McCullough suggested Steve Coogan, simply Steve Coogan. Pete Bastian, who is guested here on Remaker's Mark in the past, suggested Adrian Brody. I want to see him snap, he said. And then Lisa Lerke suggested Bradley Cooper for Jack. Someone that pretty has to have some crazy in them. All right, now moving on to Twitter, Eric McEwen, who has done lots of episodes of This Is Yay here on Math Is Hard, who is at Eric, A-R-I-C, suggested Steven Weber. Duh.
Wah, wah.
Yeah, so yeah. Tying into the TV movie version of that, I believe. Our good friend Josh Freeman, who has guested on Remaker's Mark as well, who's at jfreeman159, said, tough call. However, I'd cast Nicholson as Lloyd the bartender, which is pretty good. And as Andy replied on Twitter, that's a classic Freeman move. And I just love that there's a Freeman move. That's awesome. And then Marley West, who is at Marley Renee, suggested Ashton Kutcher. And then finally, my cousin and one of the additional creative consultant here for the Math is Hard Network, Steve Grotham, and I had about probably a 200-message iMessage conversation going on last night about The Shining, and he suggested Joaquin Phoenix for Jack. So I had already made my pick before he said that, so that just reinforced it for me. Amy Adams for Wendy, which I believe was Andy's pick, right?
Yes. Sorry.
That's quite all right.
Mute button.
And I listened to a pronunciation guide for this before the episode, and I'll be darned if I can remember how to pronounce it, but Kvenjane Wallace, I believe, from Beast of the Southern Wild for Danny. So in this case, it would be D-A-N-I. But I think that's a really interesting choice, and I would really like to see that. She got a lot of acclaim for that movie, so it doesn't mean that it has to be a dude. It can certainly be a female character. So I really like those. So thank you to you all for your feedback. That's very much appreciated. Again, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at username MathIsHardNet. Now we want to do just a quick overview of last episode's casting discussion. So we all provided our major, minor, and director casting choices, and we would just want to say who the big winners were for that, and then ultimately who the winner was and who picked the next movie and what that will be. So in the role of Dick Halloran, the winner was my choice of Forrest Whitaker. In the role of Danny Torrance, the winner was Andy and Mark, who chose Asa Butterfield. For Wendy Torrance, the winner was Lee's choice of Evangeline Lilly. For Jack Torrance, the winner was Mark's choice of Aaron Eckhart. And for the director, we went with Jer's choice of David Fincher. And now this wasn't put into the voting, but just for fun, we voted on it anyways, or this wasn't counting towards our big winner. But the minor character winner was Andy's choice of Daniel Day-Lewis for Lloyd the Bartender. It'll be the most epic, stalwart conversation role choice ever. So the big winner here, and it was really, really close. We each had one, but by virtue of Mark and Andy choosing Asa Butterfield, Mark was the winner once again. So dang it, Mark, you come back and 2 weeks in a row, you're the winner. So congrats on that. Well done.
Can I help with a high rule?
Well, I think, yes. I think you can help it a little. Just don't try so hard.
Sorry.
No, that's all right. So, Mark, tell us what your choice is for the next movie.
I think I will, thank you. Our next movie that we will be discussing is the 90s classic comedy, So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Nice.
Love it. Yay.
Yeah, our first 90s choice. That's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
Second, which was the first one?
Usual Suspects.
Oh yeah, good call. Yeah. That's
very
been a while.
Similar movies.
Wow. It's true. Very similar. We've been doing this long enough that I've forgotten our choices. That's awesome. Good work, us. Yeah. So it'll be interesting to cast that, and that's going to be a lot of fun. And I think there'll be a lot of devoted fans of that who will have lots of opinions about what would be good to recast those roles. So Mark, congrats again, and that's a great choice. So we will be discussing.
Thank you.
So I Married an Axe Murderer going forward, and we'll let you know at the end of the episode when that will be published. So now we are going to move on to our plot, tech, and filmmaking changes, or just discussion about The Shining and our remake of it. So one of the things that we talked about in pre-production that is what makes The Shining The Shining. And in this particular instance, it's not necessarily the book or the origin material. It's Stanley Kubrick and his directing style, or what we called the Kubrickness. I don't know if that's an actual word. We're going to make it so. Captain Picard style.
Yep. Kubrickian.
Kubrickian. I like it.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, I dig it. So a lot of our discussion was about how the movie was made and how that informed what we would want the remake to be. So would we want to sort of follow in the steps of Kubrick? Would we want to make it that style? Would we want to go completely different? But so much of it was just our appreciation of what Kubrick did with the directing. And I'm going to read just some of my notes here and how we kind of thought about it in terms of the movies today. So the contemplative slow burn style of this movie is so atypical of horror movies in general, especially compared to horror movies today. It's a far cry from the Scream-esque meta style. Torture porn and found footage movies most often released as horror movies these days. There does seem to be a small resurgence of this style, like The Conjuring of late seems to kind of be more along that slow burn, a little bit, you know, less graphic and just building up that tension. So my question is, how do we honor how the original was made, but without aping Kubrick, and what we'd really appreciate that? And so I'll start the appreciation conversation, and that dialogue. One of the things that I loved was, and what really set this movie apart at the time, and what still does, was the use of the Steadicam. So the Steadicam had been invented shortly before this. It was used in a couple movies, but this was really the movie that kind of gave it its coming out, if you will. The shots, so a Steadicam is a rig that has a camera on it that allows an operator to basically run with it, and it has fluid movement, or in this case, they actually pushed it on a wheelchair. So they have it strapped to a person's body, and they use a series of counterweights to keep the camera smooth while moving. And so the scenes where Danny is riding in the big wheel around the halls of the hotel, and the camera is following right behind him, the way they filmed that was with a Steadicam rig and pushing a guy on a wheelchair. So you have to think about, there's still some bumpiness to that, but with that Steadicam rig, it really smoothed that out. And that really took on almost a disconcerting smoothness. So audiences had really never seen anything like that, like camera movement that was that fluid, but that fast at the same time. It just, you know, for the amount of movement that it did, it was really astounding. And you were along that journey with them. What did you guys think about that? How did that feel to you? I mean, what did you think when you had first seen that?
What I think about with that Steadicam is they were able to get the camera to move fast and low to the ground, especially with the wheelchair rig that they worked up. And the guy that invented the Steadicam actually worked as the cameraman on The Shining, and he basically said, "This is how I intended it to be you. Like, this is it at its full potential. And Stanley Kubrick had a large part to do with that in making the modifications and doing what he wanted to do. One of those things was being able to take a shots through the hedge maze chase at the end, and also on the big wheel riding through the hallways, take the camera, get it low to the ground, 2 feet off the ground or so, and fast following either Danny running or the big wheel. And that had never been seen before. And it really gave a fantastic perspective shot of what Danny would have seen as his vantage point, because we're at his height. And so instead of being sort of over him looking down, we're eye level with him in a big wheel or running along the ground being chased by Jack Nicholson. And it's just, there's been a lot of that emulated since then in sort of these tracking shots and Evil Dead when they have sort of that camera running through the woods and you are the person being, yeah, yep, exactly.
Evil cam.
you are the person being chased, and it really brings you into the scene. You're following him. You're seeing things through his vantage point. And I think it's an incredibly effective way to film, and also just an effective way to bring us into the narrative with them.
There is something to be said for kind of the shaky cam. I mean, not like what's the recent big monster movie?
Cloverfield.
Thank you. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Not necessarily that level, but just to give the feel of running with somebody. I mean, that it really gives a visceral sort of feeling, but the smooth steady cam, I feel like it gives a little bit more of like an omniscient perspective on it. You connect with it in a way that is a little bit more like you understand the severity of the situation more than you simply feel the impact of it.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting with that, I mean, in Cloverfield, that makes sense because there is chaos. The thing that sets The Shining apart and what really builds that mood is that seemingly there's nothing going on there. I mean, they are the only people in a cavernous space. So there's that smoothness to it that it just, you know, implies that everything is smooth, everything is cool. You know what I mean? Like in Cloverfield, that shakiness was like, nobody knows what's going on. There is pure chaos. The viewer is in that mindset with them. And this is their way of basically establishing that sort of like almost tedium or boredom kind of thing, where it's like, what's Danny going to do? I don't know. I got a big wheel. I guess I'll ride around the hallways on that weird carpet. You know, I mean, like, and that's just like that's what his Monday was, you know, or his Tuesday or whatever. That's like all he did. And so that did that. But then all of a sudden, then suddenly you see him stop and you see two girls that you know were murdered at the end of the hallway. And so all of a sudden you're after this smooth ride, all of a sudden it's like a record scratch noise. Although thank God they didn't actually do that. But I mean, there were some musical cues that were pretty intense there too. And we'll talk about the music coming up in a little bit, but yeah, you know, it's just interesting about how for them, you know, this in theory should have been very smooth. They didn't have a lot to do. It was basically just like survival. And then survival took on a whole different mindset, but they continued to film in a way with that Steadicam that maintained that sense of smoothness, even though chaos was happening. So that to me was really, really interesting. You know, he still did some jarring things. So another Kubrickian thing that I would think about is the fast zoom. He did a lot of fast zoom shots where you see a wide perspective and then all of a sudden a hard zoom in to the faces of those girls or to the weird bear dog butt thing, whatever's going on in the room. If you haven't seen it, just watch. It's right at the very end. It's weird as hell. Nobody knows what it is, but man, is it wrong. And so there's just those things where all of a sudden it's kind of like, it's like when you watch Looney Tunes and a character sees something and their eyes goes, awooga. It's like the horror film awooga. You know, the camera zooms in like, what the hell is that? Ah! But it does so in a smooth way. I mean, filmmaking wise and focus pulling wise, it's amazingly precise. But, you know, we're along the ride with him. So the camera is the participant. So I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
I think the long camera shots also, for me, when I was watching it, lent a very steady increase in the tension from the viewer, that I was always expecting something to jump out from a doorway. Like when the scenes when Danny's just riding his big wheel around, like I had white knuckle grip on the arm of the couch because I was expecting something terrible to happen. Kyle and I talked about this kind of, I think, as I was watching the movie, but the soundtrack and the music is very strong and emotive, but at the same time, the lack of music and sound is almost equally as powerful. And there's a lot of those long camera stretches, long Steadicam shots where there's no soundtrack and there's no sound except for whatever noise the big wheel happens to be making going across those hardwood floors. And that was almost as jarring and almost just like, oh, I don't like this. Something's going to happen.
Yeah, like maybe it's the visual equivalent of it being quiet, too quiet.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, that's a great way
really,
to put it.
For a really, really long time.
It was interesting reading one of the Steadicam articles. They were talking about the sound of the big wheel on the carpet and on the floors. When they were filming it, they didn't realize how big of a contrast that would be. But when they got the dailies, they were like, holy crap, this is amazing. Like the sound that they captured, that live field sound, just was so striking that they were like, all right, we're gonna do this a little bit more because holy crap, is that awesome. That's such a great story.
Yeah, I love that. Love that scene.
One of the other filmmaking things that really brings that slow burn style and perspective into it is Stanley Kubrick. It does this a lot in his movies, but there's a lot of just very slow pans and especially in The Shining, there's a lot of just overly slow, like ridiculously slow dissolves from one scene to another.
Yeah, the crossfades. Those
crossfades. It just takes an inordinate amount of time. Like in another movie, it would be like, what is he doing? Why is this why is it going from one scene to the other? And it's taking literally 15 seconds to transition film wise from, you know, the scene of the outside of the hotel to the scene of the inside of the hotel. That's not normally how it's done, but it adds to sort of an ethereal, ghostly type feeling to the whole thing. And it's also just, it's unsettling at the same time, but it's also very calming, like that sort of calm before the storm, like you said, it's quiet, too quiet. Like it's the same kind of thing. Like you just never feel quite right about it, but it's sort of giving you the illusion of calm.
I love how a filmmaking technique that when used by someone who knows the right time to do it and the best place to do it can be so effective. And this is a weird analogy, but I view it akin to the like star swipes in Star Wars, which any other thing would be like, this is what you made in your ninth grade AV production class. It's like star swipe, you know, or like side wipe, you know, I mean, it's like from anybody else doing that, it would be ridiculous, but somehow in Star Wars, it was perfect. And here, like that ridiculously slow crossfade or that ridiculously slow dissolve. It's just so strange, but I think it heightens how you watch. This movie is set up so that whether you want to or not, you pay closer attention because of the coldness of it, because of the pace of it. You cannot help but really pay attention. It's like it's a boredom that enhances your interest, which seems so counterintuitive, but it's absolutely what happens because you're like, I have to know what's going on here. I am totally unsure of what's coming. Even after having seen it, I know what was coming. But I watched with bated breath because you don't know when, you don't know how. It's just that speed that just really draws you in. And so those things, like, it keeps you looking even closer. It keeps you looking even in a way that is more intense than if it was something fast or jarring or keeping you on your heels. So even that slow, deliberate pace keeps viewers involved in a way that to me, no other movie really can, especially in the horror genre. I just find that just fascinating.
Yeah, I would love to see somebody try to use fades that long in their PowerPoint presentation. Because I think it would be just hysterical.
I mean, from a comic standpoint, it's that scene in Spaceballs where they go from the desert back to wherever it is, and halfway through, one of the characters says, "Nice dissolve."
Nice dissolve.
Like yeah, they're about the same amount of time, and there's one used to comic effect, and here's one just to add this eerie, just unsettling scope to both shots.
Yeah, it's rare to find a good, well, I guess a consistent use of that in a comedy, but Spaceballs is another one too, like right in the opening sequence where they do that slow pan across, is it Spaceball 1? Is that the name of the
ship?
Yeah.
The ship. And it just takes forever to get from one end of the ship to the other. They just pan and pan and pan and pan.
Or another great one that I remember is an Old Spice commercial with Bruce Campbell in it, and he's kind of in a smoking jacket walking through like a library or something, and he walks by a portrait of a ship, and as he's walking, the portrait just keeps going, that painting just never ends, the super long ship. It's brilliant.
Nice. Nice. That's good. We're going to talk a little bit down the road of The Shining and pop culture, and I never quite sure, I wasn't sure that we'd get to Spaceballs and Old Spice, but man, that's awesome. Can't even help it. I like it.
It's everywhere.
Another thing that you referenced, Andy, so we talked about the kind of that slow burn, the long camera shots, the steady cam work. The other one was that the helicopter shots at the beginning. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to, because I loved that shot. It was fantastic. And there was, again, more trivia via imdb.com that camera shot had to be redone several times because I think the essentially that was a version of the Steadicam mounted onto a camera. They had to modify it somehow to, I think they actually had to attach wings to it so that it wouldn't flutter from the airspeed and things like that. But there's a shot where it looks like they drive inches over the station wagon on this beautiful mountain road. But that just, even that from the opening sequence, it's beautiful, but at the same time, it's a little bit tense and eerie just because I think maybe it's so unusual that you're initially kind of put on the defensive as an audience, or not maybe on the defensive, but kind of on the alert. The fight or flight system has already kind of kicked in. And there's, you know, even the tension of the helicopter coming so close to the car and flying past it, you're just like, ooh, it's, ah, they're going to crash. Ah, ooh.
It's similar taking tedium and make it interesting. So yeah. What is, I mean, it's a beautiful mountain drive, mind you. I mean, that there, it is a really lovely setting. I mean, it's filmed, it's very
Glacier?
Beautiful.
Glacier National Park, I think.
Yeah, that sounds right.
We'll say that.
So, you know, it works for me. Don't research it, people. so it, you know, there's certainly beauty there. There is something exceptional there. But what they're doing is they're driving hours and hours to get to a place where they're going to wait for months and months. And so they're already, and via musical cues too, and again, we're going to touch on that in a little bit here, but using the Wendy Carlos song and her kind of haunting synthesizers, it already, you're like, oh, something ain't right. I can't quite put my finger on what, but something is just off. It's askew, and it just maintains that semblance of being askew amongst this plainness and this tedium, that, and the balance of that is what I think makes it so successful.
The great thing about that scene is that you don't even really notice that there's any music behind it. I mean, I didn't until I was really analyzing it. But when you watch it, you don't even realize that if you just listen to the music, it's really eerie music. But you're watching this, you know, pretty mountain scene, and it's like, oh, this is going to be a nice little family adventure that they go on. But then this music in the back of your head is just screaming, no, it's not. And you don't. It's so subtle, but it's so perfect.
Yep, you expect it to be like da na 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 na, but instead it's just this wash of like creepy, weird, wrong synthesizers.
Which cage is match: Edvard Grieg versus Wendy Carlos.
Yeah, exactly.
Lemmy
Bartok.
Grieg.
Lemmy
Grieg. Ooh, hands
interesting.
Down.
Nice. Any other filmmaking stuff that you guys can think of that Kubrick did well? I think another thing that Kubrick does very interestingly is performances. He brings out interesting performances and actors. And I think he doesn't have a background in theater per se, but I think the performances that he tends to bring out, or that he chooses to put, or that he chose to put in, are very theatrical. They're big. So even though, like, he doesn't do sweeping camera moves that weren't steady cam. So when it was people talking, they were very static cameras. I mean, they were not moving around much aside from those quick zooms. So the dynamics in those scenes were presented by the people acting, and especially Jack Nicholson, who really chews up scenery in a big way. So, you know, aside from them like moving through hallways, the majority of the movement is from faces and like really, you know, active faces, active gestures. You know, I thought that was really interesting. You know, it was almost overacting, but it never quite got there. And again, it just helps with that unsettling piece. Anything else that you guys saw in terms of the performances overall? I mean, we touched on Shelley Duvall's bit a little bit in terms of her change. Anything else that you can think of?
Well, it's not so much the acting, but just one more thing from a cinematographic. Is that a real word?
Totally.
I don't even know.
Keep saying it enough times, it'll sound real.
From a cinematography standpoint, Kubrick's original pastime or his foundation was in photography. And mm-hmm. So he loved setting a scene, and you can really see it in Barry Lyndon, but just kind of creating a photograph within a movie. And he does a lot of that, I think, in The Shining as well, where he'll pan through a scene, and at one point, even midway through the pan, you just sort of stop and you see there's just things going on in five different places within the depth of field. And it's just sort of, there's like a moment in the pan where it's everything just sort of hits its sink, and it's just like this perfect chaos. And then it just pans past it. And I think he does a great job at allowing us to sort of follow what he sees. And he creates a lot of depth to his images. It's not just two people in the foreground talking and a blank wall or a hotel in the background. The whole world is filled with things, and he's such a detail guy that he has background things, even if it's not people. There's stuff in the background, and the scene gets filled up from front to back. And he does a good job of not only doing that, but then also telling our eyes what's important and what to see through lines and through angles and through shots to direct where our eyes should look and how to see not just what's in front of us, but to see the whole depth of the images that he's creating here. And he's just a master of that. And it's, if you look at his whole filmography, he just gets better and better at it as he does it.
Yep, very well put. Okay, so let's now, we've touched upon it a little bit, but let's move on to the sound of this movie and the music of this movie. So we've touched upon just kind of the creepiness of it. Andy described it as a malevolent force, which I just think is outstanding. Andy, do you want to touch on that a little bit? Do you want to say a little bit more about that malevolent force and what effect it had on you, and any specific thoughts you have?
No.
Tough.
I mentioned it a little bit. Wendy Carlos's soundtrack is in and of itself creepy. It's kind of amelodic, very dissonant. I think it's very intentional because the soundtrack doesn't let you get comfortable. It kind of reminded me of the story of when Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was premiered in Paris, and it was so so controversial, or not necessarily controversial is even the right word, but so unusual to the audience's ears and so dissonant that it kind of drove them crazy and into riots.
I was just going to bring that up.
So
like disconcerting.
Yeah, that's a good one. So there's that aspect of it, that even when the music is there and what could appear to be a beautiful scene, like the opening helicopter shots when they're driving through Glacier, or what is actually Glacier, but what is just kind of meant to be this very idyllic wilderness scene. But there's that soundtrack that seems out of place compared to what you're seeing and what you're hearing don't mesh. And that causes an emotional dissonance. And, that was a big striking aspect of it. But then I also mentioned earlier the scenes in the movie when there is no soundtrack, when it's strictly whatever is ambient sound, or even I think there might be a couple scenes when it's silent. I'm not even sure if I'm just making that up or not. But that is just as effective. So the use of sound, both the presence and absence of it, to me, was either, Kubrick's representation of this evil malevolent force in the hotel, or a new, an added character almost to ramp up the emotion. So that was my take on it.
If you watch Kubrick's movies, he does a fantastic job of not just making the sound or the soundtrack fit what's going on, but he, like you said, he makes it not fit in a way that makes you uncomfortable in a good way. If you watch Full Metal Jacket, there's a few different scenes where what's happening on the screen doesn't fit with what the soundtrack is. There's towards the end of Full Metal Jacket when Johnny Comes Marching Home is the song, which is this great this proud, patriotic song about soldiers coming home from war. And it's during the scene where people are just getting annihilated. And there's moments of that. It's almost satirical. It's almost tongue in cheek that he's doing it, but it's so effective. And in The Shining too, it feels like it's happy music, but it's not. And it feels like this should be a scene where Danny's just watching TV and everything's fine, but the music is saying otherwise. And it's just another one of those things that in the right hands, And Kubrick's are the right hands in my mind. It just, it works so well.
Agreed. Yeah. I love the way that strings are used. The sort of the, just that ever creeping, almost like a cricket chirp kind of thing where it's just, you know, all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, how long has that been going on? Like you notice it at some point. It never hits you over the head with it too much, but there's just that kind of like ever present string bed, like violin and viola bed, that you're kind of like, all of a sudden you realize like, wait a minute, I'm sitting on the edge of the seat. How long have I been sitting on the edge of my seat? And how long have those strings been doing that? Because you don't quite know in the moment exactly when it happens. But then when you notice it, it's like, oh, this is really something.
I'd go back to the scene we talked about in the earlier episode of, Wendy finding the typewriter and all the typed pages, like the strings start off soft and then they kind of get a little bit more frenetic and a little bit more fast and sort of chirpy, and it's there and you don't realize it until it's too late and you realize, oh crap, like you're right there with her, like realizing that this is bad, we're in a bad place now and you can't get out.
Yep, I like it. All right, that's good. Anything else that you want to add for the sound aspect, anybody? Okay, good. So, Jer, you brought up some points about differences between the book of The Shining and the movie of The Shining. So, do you want to touch on that, especially kind of how it was received in general, and especially from Stephen King, and then sort of how that changed, and then some ideas that you had about, you know, how could it be different? How could the remake be different than even the Stanley Kubrick version? How could we maybe honor that book a little bit more?
Well, that's such a loaded question. One of the things that is most, well, there's a lot, but one of the things that we had talked about in pre-production, as far as a change from the book to the movie is in the character of Jack Torrance. I think we kind of touched on this when we did our casting picks, that the character of Jack in the novels is much more of an everyman who goes insane and decides to kill his family, whether that be, and in the book, it becomes more of a supernatural thing. He's almost willed to do it by external forces, where in Kubrick's The Shining, we're not even really sure what's going on, what's real, what's not real. And I think that's really effective as far as the movie is concerned. It's not the, what the book is like, but Stanley Kubrick's ambiguity about what really is happening. Are these people all just crazy? Is this all in Jack's mind? Are there really ghosts? Is this him and a cabin fever setting in? Are all of the characters just slowly just kind of diving into madness one at a time? Or are there ghosts? Are the ghosts telling them to do it? Is it the hotel? Is it because they're buried or built on Indian burial ground? There's this, all these different things that Stanley Kubrick just sort of throws out there and says, you figure it out.
Which we've been doing for 30 years now, by the way.
Yeah. To great detail. In the book, it's much more straightforward ghost story. And that's very effective in its own means. And part of that is Jack's character just sort of gets involved with the ghost. The ghosts talk him into killing his family and sort of, you know, bringing him into this whole horrible scene. And so I guess the two main things that I guess I would bring up are the character of Jack, and then just the essence of where the bad things come from. Should we in a remake keep it as ambiguous as Kubrick did in why all this stuff is happening, and just sort of a general unease and confusion, not only with the characters, but with us as the audience? Like, why is there blood getting off of the elevator right now? Why are there all of a sudden...
Usually gets off at the second floor.
I hoped somebody would do that.
Yes!
Why is all of a sudden there's a ghost ball happening in the gold room? Why did Wendy turn around this corner and now it's just this gray cobweb-lit corridor and then it's gone? Why is there a bear and a butler in the hotel, you know, which one of them paid for the hotel room? And just all these things that we don't even know why they're there, what's happening. We, along with the characters, are just along for the ride and just are as confused and unsettled and uneasy as anybody else. Whereas in the book, if we were to remake it closer to the book, it's more of a, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but it's more of a straightforward ghost story about a family in in confinement in a hotel in the middle of nowhere, and the hotel is haunted and the ghosts affect them in different ways and eventually drive Jack to try to kill his family. So those are the two main things that I would bring up. And do we go more with what Kubrick did? Do we go more towards what the book does? Do we keep it in the middle? Do we do something different? Where do you go with those two types of things?
I think I'd kind of like to see something a little bit closer to Stephen King's original intention, where it's just a little bit more straightforward supernatural. You know, for some of my homework, one thing that I did was actually watch the original Evil Dead movie and then the recent remake, which was this year.
Oh, nice.
And in that example, the original film, while not the quality of Kubrick, was very interesting. But then the remake really, really tightened it up, kind of refocused it, gave the characters kind of new reason for being in the situation. And it ended up being much more captivating, making a whole lot more sense, and being a lot more convincing as to why they would stick around when there's obviously evil. And I guess the reason in the remake is that it's not quite so obvious that it's actually evil. For The Shining, I mean, Kubrick, I think, probably used a lot of misdirection. And as Jared said, you know, kept kind of intentionally vague. I would kind of like to see this really slow plotting approach used to tell a story, which, you know, could be much more clear, but then the suspense would be in waiting for things to happen, that sort of thing.
I think the struggle that we would find with that is that I fear, and this is sort of from the Joe Hollywood perspective, like, I think if we were to market it, we would need to market it as though it were Stephen King's The Shining, because I think the fear, especially from a fan perspective, there's a whole lot of devoted fans to this, and we're going to look at the pop culture things in a little bit here, but, you know, I think people will say they answered things that Kubrick didn't, and therefore they think they know. And I think there could be a little bit of a backlash to that. So I think people who are seeing this for the first time, who are unawares of kind of the legend of that, would have a very different experience than people who knew the original. And I think that if we suddenly made things clearer, people will see that instead of as an advantage, that it is in fact easier to understand, which can be a very good thing. They would see that as a very pejorative thing, which I don't think it necessarily is meant to be. So those are really, that's a fine line to walk. So we'd have to be careful about how we would describe that, like how we would kind of talk about it in marketing it and branding it. But I think that's an interesting idea, and I would be in support of that. I think you either need to go as vague as Kubrick or vaguer, or you need to answer a whole lot more things and wrap it up a little bit more like the book. So I think anywhere in between would just seem like you're not doing either of those end goals justice.
Did any of you guys see the more Stephen King-based The Shining movie with Steven Weber?
No, I didn't.
No.
I watched a little bit of it, and I just couldn't get into it, but it was basically Stephen King going, no, this is more what the book is. And in recent years, when it first came out, Stephen King, like most of the remakes or most of the movies based on his books, just sort of poo-pooed it and said, no, that's not what I had in mind at all. But he's softened in recent years, kind of coming to realize that this, regardless of the source material, is a phenomenal movie. And I think that's kind of what his opinion is that as a movie, it's outstanding. As a recreation of my book, it's terrible. And so I think that's kind of where Stephen King is. And so in response to that, in some ways he made another movie with Stephen Weber as Jack Torrance, which I watched it and I just couldn't get into it because all I could see was Stephen Weber's character from Wings. And that just didn't jive with me because he's such a goofball in that movie, or in the TV show. But, yeah, it just didn't. Anything that we do or anyone does is not going to feel like a Kubrick movie. And for me, and for, I would assume, a lot of fans of Stanley Kubrick, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, I would have to agree that. Sorry to jump in.
That's fine.
There would probably be a backlash amongst the Kubrick faithful about that. And, you know, one of the reasons that that the Evil Dead remake works very, very well is that it doesn't have any of that factor that it is Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell that did the remake. So it was basically them trying again. You know, maybe this one would be Stephen King trying again. So Stephen King, if you're listening, give us a call.
Hook us up, yo. Nice. Okay. Go ahead, Jerry.
You know what? Never mind. Just go.
Okay. we talked in pre-production about how we'll have to rein this one in a little bit, that both Jer and I and Mark seemingly can talk on this forever, which is awesome, but we don't want this to be 4 hours long, so we'll be aware of that and careful of that. So one filmmaking thing that I wanted to just touch on quickly, it's a little bit sound, it's a little bit technology-based, is that Danny, the way that they showed The Shining in the original one was really interesting. Like, they had a slightly modulated voice when you would hear it in his head, or when it was the scene that we discussed in the first one where it was Scatman Crothers and Danny's character kind of communicating back and forth, where Danny was essentially shining what was going on to Dick Halloran. And you know, there was like some weird modulation stuff there. Do you think we should keep it that simple? Do you think we could certainly, I mean, we've got CG a go-go now. So, you know, all of the elements in the original were practical, including the blood, which is just insane and awesome and creepy and terrible and everything all at once. So, you know, we have the ability to do a lot more than that. I love the simplicity of that original one, but I'm wondering if there's a way that we could kind of, you know, make that a little bit more clear what is going on, a little bit more apparent, and it would also be a way maybe to honor some more of that lineage as far as where that's coming from, some more of the spirit of the hotel, or kind of the shining of the hotel itself. So what do you guys think about that? Do you think that would be helpful? Do you think that would be a bad idea? Any other ideas along those lines?
I'm personally in favor of Danny kind of being more of a medium, and Kyle, I think you had mentioned this idea earlier, but something like the hotel and the ghosts in it kind of communicating through him or her. And I think with the effects that we can bring to it now, I would hope that we would use them tastefully, but I think it could be just terrifying.
Yeah, imagine if he inhabited, or if he suddenly, you know, you don't really know when he sees the 10 and the 8-year-old girls, like, is he truly seeing them? Is it just a vision? Like, imagine if that started out in his head before it became visual. Like, imagine he's whipping down the hallway and suddenly hears, like, come play with us, Danny, like, before you ever see him. You know, things like that where we can do surround sound. I mean, even then, that's getting pretty complicated. But, like, you know, stuff where we can have stuff whipping around in the tracks and just being really active that way. That, to me, would be a good way to ratchet that up a little bit while honoring the original at the same time and not going completely overboard where it's like swooshing effects and, you know, he sees in different colors or whatever.
I don't think the one thing that I think that would benefit is it's really not very well explained through the narrative, which is largely Scatman Crothers, what exactly Danny's ability does or is, or where it came from. Not that you have to go into, you know, he's the seventh son of the seventh son or whatever like that, but just what does he have the capability of doing and what doesn't he? And when he's staring off into space, foaming at the mouth, what is actually happening? Besides the fact that he's communicating somehow something with Halloran. Other than that, we don't really know what's going on. Is he possessed? Is he intentionally communicating and crying for help, or is it just sort of a trance? Like, there's not really a lot of explanation as far as what this ability or power is, and does he have control of it? All of that stuff is just sort of vaguely talked about at the beginning when they're in the pantry and Dick Halloran is talking to Wendy, and then he turns and looks at Danny and speaks to Danny. While he's actually speaking with his mouth to Wendy, he's speaking with his mind to Danny at the same time.
Canned fish and meats, hot and cold cereals, post toasters, corn flakes, sugar puffs, Rice Krispies, oatmeal, wheat thin and cream of wheat. You got a dozen jugs of black molasses. We got 60 boxes of dry milk. Rolls and seven kinds of what have you. Now we got dried peaches,
That's really the only real clear, like, okay, this is sort of a telepathy kind of thing. But other than that, we really don't know what it is. And to more clearly explain that, and you can either do that through the narrative, you can do that with effects, you can do it with however you want. I just wouldn't want this to become a green screen fest, and I don't think it would be. I think what you're talking about with very subtle things that would be what Kubrick would have done if he had additional technologies like surround sound and things like that, how he would have made that without being obnoxious about it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I like that. That's a good summation. Okay, so the last thing before we wrap up here is we want to touch a little bit on The Shining in pop culture. So this movie has had a huge effect on many things. It had a huge effect on filmmaking with Steadicam work. It had a huge effect on how people viewed horror movies and what they could be, sort of a more cerebral, psychological horror movie. And it was different than what came before and really a lot of what came after. There's so many things that The Shining has sort of interspersed itself amongst our lives, but there are some things that are very deliberate in their influence in pop culture. Some of these things are very obvious. Some of these things are less so. One of the more obvious things of late was that there is a documentary about The Shining and about people who are basically conspiracy theorists around The Shining called Room 237, which was the room in which much of the evil happened in the original movie. Jer, correct me if I'm wrong, but you saw this movie, correct?
Several times.
Oh, very good. I still have not seen it, ashamedly, but I very much want to. Can you maybe just give a summary of the movie and tell us a little bit about that? Just, give us an idea.
There's actually two documentaries that I've seen about The Shining and different theories and conspiracy theories about it. Room 237 is marketed much better, and it's actually quality-wise a little bit better, but there's another one that you can find that really just talks about The Shining being the conspiracy theory is that The Shining is Stanley Kubrick and his plea to the economists and the government to get us back to the gold standard, which is just sort of a strange, baffling concept. But that's a different one. And then in Room 237, it's basically conversations and interviews with about five or six different people who have picked apart the Shining to an alarming degree, and the different theories that they have pulled from that, and they range from the Shining being Stanley Kubrick wanting to make a film about World War II and the horrors of the Nazis without actually making a movie about World War II, and he actually had a grand plan to make one, and then it just sort of was not killing him, but it was emotionally wrecking him as he researched this movie. And so finally he just scrapped it and said, you know what? Schindler's List was better than what I'm going to do anyway. And so, some people think that this was his, the spirit of that movie in a completely different way, and how he could tell the story of the horrors of what the Nazis did without actually taking us to World War II, to the plight of the Native Americans in this country, other just sort of baffling things. People think that he put in there that he may or may not, that there's, one of the character, the Jack Nicholson is the Minotaur, and this is just a retelling of the Greek story of the Minotaur in the labyrinth. And then my personal favorite, and one that I've researched online quite a bit because I believe it strongly. Actually, you didn't see that, but that was sarcastic. I was rolling my eyes at the same time.
You did the sarcasm marks. Okay.
I rolled my eyes. There is a pretty pervasive theory that Stanley Kubrick was hired by the government prior to filming the Shining to film the faked moon landing. And he felt so broken up about it that when he made The Shining, he essentially admitted to that in The Shining in very subtle ways.
That's pretty subtle.
It's very, yeah. But then when you watch it, you realize that it's not subtle at all. He's just basically screaming to us, I faked the moon landing, you people. And it's just beautiful how much this movie has permeated people's curiosity. And there's so many layers to both real and imagined to to Kubrick and this movie. And it's just fun reading about it, reading just how ridiculous some of the theories become and how you can kind of see when you look at Kubrick's body of work and just who he was as a person. Okay, maybe they're not too far off on this. So it's a fun little hobby that I've developed, and probably it should stop.
Everyone needs a hobby.
Indeed. And Jerry, you did a Nerd Night presentation on this. So let's maybe share your slide rockets slides from that. We didn't end up turning that into a podcast of Nerd Night here on Math is Hard, just because from a technology perspective, it didn't lend itself very well to that format. So it never ended up making it into the full-blown podcast. But maybe we could at least share the slide rocket slides from that so people can have an idea about some of those conspiracy theories.
Yeah, and I've actually done two. I've done one just simply on the faked moon landing, and then one on sort of room 237 and the pervasiveness of all the different theories as well, which is the one you're talking about.
Right on. Cool. So I will put that in the show notes. And then the one aspect of pop culture, which is my personal favorite, was that The Shining was the inspiration for an episode or one of the segments in a treehouse of horror from The Simpsons called The Shining, where Bart plays Danny and groundskeeper Willie plays the role of Dick Halloran, and Homer is the writer who slowly goes crazy. And it is one of my favorite Simpsons bits of all time, and it's just exceptionally well done and just hilarious. And it's a beautiful homage, and it makes fun of it at the same time. And it's really well animated, and you know, it has the instead of all work and no play and make Jack a dull boy, it's no TV and no beer make Homer go crazy. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely, don't mind if I do. Yep.
Homie, what he's typed will be a window into his madness. Feeling fine. Wow, that's a relief. This is less encouraging.
Hello!
What do you think, Marge? All I need is a title. I was thinking along the lines of no TV and no beer make Homer something something.
Go crazy?
Don't mind if I do!
It so perfectly mixes what is great about The Shining with what is great about The Simpsons, and it's imminently quotable. It's just so good. If I could just somehow insert the whole episode in this, I would do so, and I don't think Simpson or the Fox's lawyers would be too keen upon that. So seek it out. I think it's Treehouse of Horror 5 or 6. I'll put the show notes in the Wikipedia page for that. But it is so funny and so well done. It's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Treehouse of Horror of all time. And they call it The Shining, and he says, "Quiet lad, do you want to get sued?" So yeah, it's just top notch. It's fantastic. And there are many, many other. We've got a link to a Flavor Wire article that we'll include in there. There's some that are a little bit more obscure, a little bit more broad, but there's just so many things in the world that the Shining has permeated in terms of pop culture. Anything else that you guys can think of or want to discuss?
One of my favorites is there was a little bit of an internet sensation, a YouTube sensation that went through a couple of years ago where people would take movies and recast or recut them up to make a movie trailer for the movie in a completely different theme than the movie actually is. And one of the first ones that they did, and one of the most popular ones, is from The Shining. And they recut the trailer, and called it Shine. And it was, the way they recut it made it look like a sort of a family drama about this family that goes in the mountains and has this really great time and bonds together and, you know, just becomes closer as a family. And the soundtrack behind the trailer is
Peter Gabriel.
Peter Gabriel, and it's,
yep,
it's Salisbury hilarious.
Hill, is that right?
Salisbury Hill, yep.
Yep.
Thank you. I could not remember what it was, but it's, if you watch it and you're like, oh, that looks like a good movie. We should take the family to see that. And it both is funny in its own right, but it also shows you how important sound and what Kubrick did, it meant so much. And so all you have to do is change those things and it just becomes something completely different.
Yeah, I included the link to Brokeback to the Future, the one that we referenced in the second half of Back to the Future. So that's if you want to go back to the Back to the Future Part 2 episode, there is a link to that in there because we discussed that. So definitely check that out, of the same light. So a little bit different subject matter, but same kind of idea in terms of recutting that trailer, which was just awesome. So yeah,
it's perfect. Yep.
Yep. Indeed. All right. Well, I think we certainly did this justice. I think we could continue on for hours and hours, but I think for our viewers' perspective, if you're staring at your phone right now, good on you. But for our listeners' perspective, we probably should not go on forever and ever and ever. So good conversation, guys. Thanks. So that wraps up the second part of our discussion of The Shining. If you'd like to find out more information about this podcast or other podcasts or blogs on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. You can also find show notes for this podcast and others there. So links and actors and actresses and movies that we have discussed here, we link to all of those on there. So if we mention something that you would like to find out more about, we'd link to that so that you can do so very easily and always go back to that episode. And that's included in the file if you subscribe in iTunes or if you subscribe in an RSS reader or anything like that. The show notes are included in that document itself, in that MP3 itself. So you can get all that right there. It's very handy. But you can also go to mathishard.net. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at username MathIsHardNet, so definitely check us out there and let us know how we're doing. Our next episode will be released on October 7th, where we'll be discussing So I Married an Axe Murderer, which is going to be a lot of fun. So, gentlemen, as always, conspiracy theories aside, this has been a wonderful time. No, I'm just kidding. It's all been good. I just wanted to say that. It's such a wonderful time to hang out and chat with you and pick your brains and basically just geek out together. So thank you, as always, for your opportunity to do that. And as always, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.